Part of the reason that DOMA doesn't make sense is that traditionally marriage has been decided by the states. And right now, I understand there's a little debate going on here in New York.
That, of course, was President Obama, and that, of course, was before the vote. It was at the LGBT fundraiser in Manhattan a week ago, the day before the same-sex marriage bill passed in Albany. And the president's been asked several times since Friday's historic vote about his views on gay marriage, and he has repeatedly said that marriage is the business of the states. So to put this into context, and he did it again yesterday at his news conference, we thought we would look into other instances in American history where states' rights have been invoked. Segregationists invoked states' rights. That's probably the most famous example, as did defenders of slavery and opponents of civil rights legislation, the two most famous examples, really, but also opponents to the Patriot Act and proponents of states' rights to regulate marijuana. Joining us now to explain the ins and outs of the longstanding states' rights debate is the constitutional scholar and professor at the University of Texas School of Law, Sanford Levinson. Welcome to WNYC, Professor. Hello from New York.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
And we understand there's a fire, a test, not a fire, but a test of an alarm system going off in the hotel where you are, but that it's going to end momentarily. So everybody just bear with it. And the test will be passed with flying colors, no doubt. And then they'll be quiet. So because this issue is coming up at this time, because of the same-sex marriage bill passing in Albany, explain how a New York law could coexist with federal law, the Defense of Marriage Act, which defines marriage as between a man and a woman nationally.
Well, I mean, this is part of what federalism is all about. If you take federalism seriously, it is a protection of diversity. Diversity has its good aspects and its very bad aspects. You mentioned slavery and segregation, which is certainly the most evil face of diversity. But there are other kinds of diversity as well, including, you know, the state's abilities to have more liberal marriage policies if they wish, to have more liberal workers' rights policies than they wish, to have more liberal environmental policies if they wish. And then sometimes there'll be a conflict between the federal and the state governments. And if there's an out-and-out conflict, the federal government will almost always win. DOMA is not a direct conflict. What DOMA says is that the national government and other states don't have to recognize marriage laws of the given state.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that New York can't have its own marriage law and its own state policies.
And then, even though the president opposes DOMA, at the news conference yesterday, he seemed to kind of walk up to the line of endorsing same-sex marriage at the state level as, excuse me, as a good thing rather than something he's not taking a position on. Listen to this.
What you saw was the people of New York having a debate.
And then he concludes.
They made a decision to recognize civil marriages. And I think that's exactly how things should work.
But it was kind of fudged because he was really almost endorsing New York State, endorsing civil marriages as the way things should work. But he was also saying that having the states do it on a state-by-state basis is the way things should work. So the gay and lesbian community wants him to go further in saying, no, 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 establishing this as a federal civil right is the way things should work. So that's the issue right now, right?
Right, yeah.
So looking again historically, marriage played into legislating civil rights. Anti-miscegenation laws, couldn't marry between races, existed in some states until 1967. Laws that Obama critics point out would have prevented his parents from marrying. So marriage has entered the states versus federal law debate in the past?
I think that's absolutely right. That marriage. Are you there?
I am here.
Yep. Okay. That marriage.
And there's no fire there, right? This is a test of the fire alarm system. And I'm just reassuring everybody. Our guest is not going to burn up out of dedication to being a guest on this show. They're just testing a fire alarm system at the hotel at which he is staying. Go ahead.
Yep. No, I think it is accurate to say that traditionally marriage was regulated by the states, but it's also completely accurate to say what you said a few moments ago was that that tradition came crashing to an end in the 1960s over the issue of race, which has been the principal issue of states' rights in our history. And there the Supreme Court held that the 14th Amendment, with its command that no person shall be denied equal protection of the laws, meant that a state could not deny a marriage license simply on the basis that the applicants were of different races. And so, David Boies and Ted Olson, who are leading the litigation in California with regard to the California ban on same-sex marriage, are saying that there's really no difference, ultimately, in moral or legal weight between the refusal of a state to sell a marriage license to people who are of, quote, the wrong race, as against refusing to sell a marriage license to people who don't fit the state's preferred notion of sexual orientation. I personally think that's a fine argument, and it ought to prevail. It is still generally the case that states have wide berth on marriage laws, but it's narrower than it used to be.
People tend to think that Democrats like centralized power and Republicans like decentralized state control. But it's not as simple historically as that, right? I'm thinking of the marijuana legalization or decriminalization movement, for example.
Right. Now, federalism arguments are often opportunistic. It really depends ultimately on what the issue is. I mentioned before environmental regulation, there are lots of states these days that are more progressive than the national government with regard to environment.
And there are conservatives who are saying states shouldn't be allowed to be more progressive than the federal government?
Right. Or actually a very interesting issue where the Supreme Court is split in very interesting and unpredictable ways is over the issue of so-called punitive damages in tort suits, where the damages might be, let's say, $1 million, and then the jury awards another $10 million in punitive damages because it's so outraged at what the company did. The Supreme Court is all over the place on this, but what's interesting is that Justice Scalia, who is normally viewed as the arch conservative, believes that states have a right to have whatever policies they want on punitive damages. And the pro-business conservatives, like Chief Justice Roberts and the like, are outraged at the ability of states to award these kinds of heavy punitive damages and say that the 14th Amendment prohibits that. There have been several cases over the last several years dealing with the ability of states, including Vermont, to allow victims of medical malpractice a freer right to sue, even when the manufacturers of products that are being sued can claim some sort of federal authorization through the FDA. And again, that's not a kind of traditional liberal conservative split. Justice Breyer, who generally is a very strong nationalist, is not sympathetic to liberating the states. Justice Thomas, who is a very strong states' right buff, is willing to let Vermont have its own policy. But if you, you know, if you ask the person in the street on this, it's going to break down, you know, very much, I think, on liberal conservative grounds.
Yeah. And you just another example that flips the traditional roles is the so-called Secure Communities program.
That's right.
Federal program, which compels local law enforcement to forward fingerprints of alleged criminals to the U.S. Immigration Office.
Right.
But we have New York and a few other states opting out to protect undocumented immigrants, but conservatives say no, the federal law should prevail. Before you go, this also pertains to the Tea Party movement. Ask a Tea Partier what's the most important thing to you in the Constitution, because you're always invoking the Constitution, and they'll probably say the 10th Amendment, states' rights, everything that's not expressly given to the federal government in the Constitution is reserved for the states. So is that code for something else? Is that because the Tea Party movement is really concerned about specific policies that they think are more likely to be enacted if the states have more power? Because I don't think people walk around generally thinking in the abstract, oh, states are so much better than the federal government or need to be so independent. It's tied to policy outcomes that they want, right?
Okay. First of all, the 10th Amendment does not include the word expressly. There was a motion made in 1789 when the 10th Amendment was being considered by Congress to include the magic word, and Congress made the very, very explicit decision not to include it. So part of the debate between liberals and conservatives for what is now literally a couple centuries is the importance of the fact that expressly was omitted. But you're right that the Tea Party, in effect, reads expressly into it. But you're also right that the Tea Party itself is conflicted on this. I mean, look at Michelle Bachmann, who professes to be a very, very strong states' rights buff, but who also says that she would support a constitutional amendment that would prohibit New York from having its own policy on marriage because she is so committed to the sanctity of heterosexual marriage.
Right.
So I think ultimately for everybody except certain lawyers, but I think even with regard to most lawyers, most of the arguments are going to be opportunistic at the end of the day.
The 10th Amendment provides that powers not granted to the federal government nor prohibited to the states by the Constitution are reserved respectively to the states or the people.
Right.
I mean, that sounds very specific. Why would the word expressly change it?
Well, because the...
And we have 30 seconds.
Right. The rabbit in the hat is the necessary and proper clause that concludes Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. That gives Congress the power to pass all laws that they view as necessary and proper. And John Marshall, in an 1819 decision, defined necessary really to mean convenient or useful. So once you read the Article 1, Section 8, to give Congress that sort of wide power, mm-hmm. then the lack of expressly really does open the door. That door was opened, almost 200 years ago, and Congress has legislated ever since.
These ideas will be tested again in the coming term of the Supreme Court over federal health care legislation, most likely in the Arizona immigration law. And we leave it there with Sanford Levinson, professor at the University of Texas School of Law. Thank you for filling us in on this history, and I'm glad the fire alarm system is working so well at your hotel.
I apologize to your listeners for what must have been the background noise, but thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Brian Lehrer and WNYC coming up in a minute. We'll wrap up our new Little series in Little Tibet in Sunnyside, Queens, and Little Brazil in Astoria. Stay tuned.